Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. How are you today?
Well, thanks, Steve. How about yourself?
I'm doing just great. I've got a little update here about that Chinese balloon, which entered over Canada before drifting into the States and getting shot down. It appears it drifted over a Minuteman ICBM site, amongst other things. And the question is, in this day and age, why use a balloon for intelligence gathering? You know, China already has reconnaissance or spy satellites in low Earth orbit, able to photograph those missile sites and other military installations. So why bother with such dated technology? And I think we'll throw a little history into here. It's important to note that in 1956, the U.S. sent hundreds of spy balloons over Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, and China as part of Weapons Systems 119L, which is also known as Project Gentrix. Now, the first test balloon, created incidentally by those good folks at General Mills who make Cheerios, Lucky Charms, and Cocoa Puffs, was loaded with radars and photographic systems, launched from Lowry Air Force Base, no relation, and landed in Canada in New Brunswick. Subsequent to that, a total of 516 espionage balloons were launched from sites in Scotland, Norway, West Germany, and Turkey. And of those 516, only 54 were recovered. And of those, only 31 produced useful photographs. So the balloons were merely stopgap measures until the U-2 spy plane and reconnaissance satellites became operational. And since China does have spy satellites, why use balloons now? Oh, and now here's another interesting sidebar, Tim. The Soviets recovered many of those spy balloons, and their temperature-resistant and radiation-hardened films were later used by them in the Luna 3 moon probe, which they launched in 1959 and captured the world's first images of the far side of the moon, thus taking a giant leap forward for the Russians.
You know, what the Chinese are up to is likely going to take quite some time to verify. Let's get on to today's topic, which is about trying to understand the magnitude of scales in space, which are literally astronomical. And here's a quote from Neil Armstrong about his impressions of landing on the moon and looking back at our planet. He said, quote, "I didn't feel like a giant. I felt very, very small."
Tim, as we found out by doing a little bit of research, space presents us with extremes of measurement from the very small to the extremely large in temperatures, distances, and speeds. And in this episode, we're going to try to tackle those three areas to get a better understanding of them. But before we do, perhaps we should take a warning from American astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who says, quote, "The universe is under no obligation to make sense to you."
And I've certainly found that to be the case, Steve. When we start examining numbers such as 3 billion degrees Celsius, or 5 million light years, or 27,000 kilometers per second, I think we have to have a better understanding of the limits of the human brain itself. For example, we know that neuroscience has determined that humans are hardwired to try to perceive inanimate patterns as images of faces, and this is called pareidolia. As such, our brains see patterns and perceive them to be things like man in the moon, a religious figure in a blotch on a wall, or a rock formation on Mars. Similarly, with regard to numerical cognition, our brains are hardwired not to understand large numbers, but to compare them. And that's what we are going to try to do today.
Did a little research and found that it's proven that we are extremely good at seeing a small collection of items and knowing exactly how many there are. For example, if you're shown three coins on a table, you instantly know there are three. You don't have to count them. However, lab experiments have proven our limit of being able to look at a number of items and instantly know that exact number is five. Anything larger than five, and we have to resort to counting. So if you look at something, well, let's say seven coins, we tend to unconsciously make two smaller subgroups, let's say of four and three. Now, if you wish, there are YouTube videos demonstrating this human limitation.
Accepting that as one human limitation, we have to consider another, which is the ability to understand large numbers. Most people have a good understanding that a classroom holds 20 or 30 people, and that a movie theater might hold 200, or in a hockey arena, you might see 20,000. However, when looking at a very large crowd of people, this ability breaks down and we end up resorting to clumping. Using a mental image of a movie theater of, say, 200 people, we sort of cookie cutter our way around things to say how many people are in a larger crowd.
Well, Tim, this can work fairly well for small numbers up to perhaps a few hundred, but after that, our ability breaks down. And let's try using money as an example of this. We know how much $20 is and can pretty much understand 100 or maybe even a few hundred. Let's, however, try to understand a large number such as $25 million, which is about that of a small city's budget. Now, in itself, $25 million is a number which our brain simply can't comprehend, but we do know what a 25 is. So when comparing a city's budget increase from last year of, let's say, $24.5 million to this year's 25, we can easily understand that the difference is a mere 0.5, but we give little thought to the fact that that 0.5 represents $500,000. And that's one of those large numbers we really don't understand.
Another human numerical limitation is the confusion presented by even simple larger numbers. For example, it's easy for us to understand the difference between 2 and 5. It's 3. But that somehow becomes more difficult when comparing the difference between 62 and 65, even though the answer is still 3. And so, with cognitive limitation in mind, let's have a look at some astronomically large numbers dealing with temperature. And we should begin with units of measurement. In 1970, Canada began using metric units, more properly called SI, which stands for System International, rather than the Fahrenheit scale. To add to confusion, astronomers and astrophysicists used the Kelvin temperature scale.
Yeah, I kind of think it's interesting to note that all three scales are honorifics, named for the Pole, Daniel Fahrenheit, the Swede, Anders Celsius, and the Irishman, William Thompson, who became the first Baron of Kelvin.
Baron Kelvin, who knew? People often roll their eyes at the mention of billions, or they get exercised if they've been asked to switch from Fahrenheit to Celsius. And if you start to factor in these cognitive guardrails that make us struggle with numbers that are particularly large or small, well, it's easier to see why it can feel like you've got brain cramp underway if you focus too long on the size of the universe or the smallest of particles. The coldest ever recorded on Earth is 184 Kelvin, which doesn't sound too bad, but it's minus 89 Celsius. Outer space has a baseline measurement of 2.7 degrees Kelvin, equates to a frosty minus 270 degrees Celsius. The absolute coldest spot so far detected in space is just 1 degree Kelvin in the Boomerang Nebula. But amazingly, and this is really incredible, in October of 2021, German scientists managed to create an even colder temperature, just 38 trillionth of a degree away from absolute zero. How? Well, they managed this by dropping freezing magnetized gas down a tower 120 meters tall. And the amazing thing is, this work was recorded on a video that can be viewed on YouTube.
And so we go from zero Kelvin, the coldest possible state where atomic motion ceases and the universe literally freezes over, to extremely hot temperatures. And let's begin with the Earth's core. Now, due to gravitational compression and natural radioactive decay, Earth's core is estimated to be about 6,000 degrees Kelvin or 5,000 degrees Celsius. To try to make sense out of this temperature, you typically roast meat in an oven, and that oven is set for 180 degrees Celsius. So the Earth's core is 30 times hotter than your oven. Now, 30 times hotter than an oven is something that I can come to grips with. Well, at least I understand what the number 30 is.
As promised, Steve, we are going to start throwing out some big numbers. The temperature at the center of planet Earth was, as you said, 5,000 degrees Celsius. Lava reaching the surface during a volcanic eruption is about 1250 C. Then there is the center of our sun, 15 million degrees Celsius. And as someone said, comparisons are odious, but we have to go on and say the sun is some 3,000 times hotter than the Earth core. Now, scientists have their own way to translate numbers using exponential notation. So, for example, they would denote 15 million as 15 times 10 to the sixth power. It works for scientists, I suppose, but I'm still not convinced there is a way to make sense of a number like 100 billion, and that is the estimated number of stars in the Milky Way.
Well, to give an idea of the magnitude of jumping from just a million to a billion, and we do that all the time, as does the media, let's try to use something that we're familiar with, and let's play a version of Jeopardy while doing so. Here we go. Now, we certainly know how long a day is, and we have a pretty good idea of how long 12 days is. And in those 12 days, there are 1 million seconds. Now, your task, Tim, and listeners, is to calculate how many days it will take to reach a billion seconds. And remember, there are 1,000 million in a billion. So you're tasked with trying to find out how many days will it take to make a billion seconds. And the answer is not 100 days. It's not 1,000 days. No, it will take 31 years to reach a billion seconds. And I, for one, can't wrap my head around that. It takes 12 days to reach a million, but 31 years to reach a billion.
Well, that is incredible. I've got another one for you, Steve. Let's imagine a banker with an enormous vault stuffed with $100 bills. His job? He's got to stack those bills until he's piled up $1 million. Now, I haven't done this myself, but if I did, it would result in a stack that is 100 centimeters high, a little bit higher than an average windowsill. Having done that, the banker is now told to stack the $100 bills until there is a billion. How high would that reach? 200 centimeters? 500 centimeters? Well, it turns out the answer is an astounding 1 kilometer high.
Let me get this right, Tim. $100 bills, you stack them up to make a million, and that $1 million pile is 100 centimeters tall. But if I wanted $1 billion, it would have to go how high?
1 kilometer. And it speaks to how difficult it is for the average person to really take on board the meaning of $1 million versus 1 billion. The numbers and the differences are beyond our ready comprehension.
Again, the supposedly mere jump from a million to a billion astounds me. Well, one way for astronomers to get around immense numbers is to use comparisons. And let's do this for stellar masses. So rather than saying our sun has a mass in kilograms of 2 times 10 to the 30th, which means a 2 followed by 30 zeros, they simply refer to the sun as having one solar mass. And rather than saying the star Betelgeuse, for example, has a mass in kilograms of 2.2 followed by 31 zeros, it's simply referred to as having a mass of 25 solar masses.
This comparative system not only applies to astronomical masses, but for distances as well. For example, the distance from the Earth to the sun isn't referred to as 147 million kilometers. It's referred to as one astronomical unit. And so, rather than saying Mars is 228 million kilometers from the sun, it's noted as being 1.5 astronomical units, or AUs. For really large distances in space, the light year unit is used, and it's important to note that a light year is a measurement of distance and not time.
Yes, so many times you might see in a movie where somebody says, oh, I haven't seen you in light years. Well, a light year is a distance that a photon of light will travel in 1 year as it zips along at the blazing speed of 300,000 kilometers per second. And using the light year scale, in space, the average distance between two stars is 5 light years. And the distance to our nearest star, other than the sun, is Proxima Centauri, and it's 4.3 light years away.
Steve, it just wouldn't be right to focus on the measure of the cosmos without mentioning one of the great communicators of modern cosmology, Carl Sagan. After Einstein and Stephen Hawking, I suspect Sagan's name is near the top of any such list. And in particular, Sagan was determined to update popular understanding of the scale of our universe. A big part of that challenge was to break down the barriers we humans have built up in defense of even thinking about the extreme distances of space, the emptiness, the extremes of hot and cold.
And getting back to Carl Sagan, Tim, on the bright side, in 1543, Copernicus did challenge the prevailing geocentric notion that the Earth was the center of the universe, and we live on a planet where literally everything in the sky, the entire heavens, revolves around us in perfect circles.
Well, there was progress there, but Sagan wanted to bring us down another few notches when he said the following. Who are we? We find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star lost in a galaxy tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe in which there are far more galaxies than people. End quote. Now, that's a notion that really gave me pause. More galaxies in the universe than people on our planet. Sagan would frequently stress the letter B when speaking about the billions upon billions of stars. In fact, after many appearances on late night shows such as Johnny Carson's The Tonight Show, Carson would mock Sagan's delivery by exaggerating the phrase for comedic effect, billions and billions. Now, Sagan took the jibes with humility, but he eventually got his reward, or perhaps recognition is a better way to say this. A new term was invented in his honor. It was called the Sagan, and it was a unit of measure to describe anything that has more than 4 billion units.
One of Sagan's more famous projects was estimating the number of stars in the known universe. And Tim, you can just imagine the challenge of even knowing where to start. First of all, how many galaxies are there? Because galaxies vary greatly in age, size, and shape. Well, at any rate, in 1980, Sagan estimated that the number of stars in the universe was a 10, followed by 22 zeros. And I'm not even going to try to say if it was a bazillion or a quadrillion or whatever. And recently improved space probes, such as the Hubble telescope and the James Webb telescope, have increased that number to a 3, followed by 23 zeros. But really, nobody can understand that number. So you can see why it's not surprising if you've got, an infinite number of stars with perhaps another infinite number of planets around them, that the notion of life outside our planet is hardly a stretch. Indeed, more recent analysis of the cosmos strongly suggests that there are more planets than stars in the universe. And if you consider our sun as being a typical star, it's got 9 planets or 10, whether you want to include Pluto or not. So if you've got 20 stars times our 10, that's 200 planets right there.
To bring that staggering number a little closer to home, let's focus on just our own galaxy, the Milky Way. Current estimates find that there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and remember, 8 billion people on the Earth. More stars in our galaxy than people on our planet. And those stars are spread out across a mind-numbing distance of 100,000 light years. That got me wondering about the number of times our own sun circles the black hole in the middle of the Milky Way, that being called Sagittarius A. It was photographed in May of 2022 by the Event Horizon Telescope, which was an electronically connected array of telescopes. So here's the question I asked myself and found a pretty simple answer. How many times has our sun circled that black hole? The math is actually quite simple, and the number is pretty low, 20. And that's done by noting that it takes our sun 226 million years to circle the Milky Way, traveling at 230 kilometers per second. The sun is thought to be 4.6 billion years old. You do the math? Well, recently, our sun celebrated its 20th trip around Sagittarius A, the black hole at the center of our galaxy.
Imagine giving someone a birthday card and they've just turned 20, and inside you've written, "Congratulations, you're now as old as the sun."
My mind is beginning to hurt, Steve, and with all these numbers, and it just reminds me of Gary Larson's cartoon where the high school student asks to be excused from class. Why? Because his head is full. Be sure to tune in next week when our topic will be UFOs. And until then, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we're looking forward to seeing you next time on Space Talks.